The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Good morning and you're very welcome to the show on this glorious day. I'm looking at the front of the Sunday Times here and there is a family marching on to the British Bay, County Wicklow, and it's a military operation. They have all their gear and they're marching with intent to get down to the beach. And I think Irish people are rediscovering this kind of a beach culture. There's a great thing at the end of the caption on that piece. They have their flagging piece they have on page 3, and it says Ireland, quotes, as good as Spain. And you see, this is what it's all about for us, isn't it? We love hearing that it is hotter here than in some of the other so-called hotspots where we used to go on holidays in the good old days. And we're also like, we're competitive with ourselves now. So Friday was the hottest day of the year, 28 degrees. We beat that on Saturday with 29 point something degrees. So I suppose the question for the nation now is, can we hit that 30 degrees today? Can we do it, people? I think we can. Now, as much as you would swear there wasn't a problem in the world when you see that family marching onto the beach, there are, of course, problems in the world. So let's not lose the run of ourselves. The Sunday Times actual lead story is that under 16s are to get COVID jabs this summer. And they're also talking about a mix and match vaccine booster program in the autumn for at-risk adults. So that means that whatever vaccine you've already got, you might get a different one. A heterologous, isn't it? That seems to be growing evidence that that's more effective. I'll just point you to the Sunday Telegraph. They also have scientists in England. I know they don't always listen to them, but the headline on the Sunday Telegraph is children will only be jabbed if vulnerable. Ministers decide against mass vaccination for teenagers on advice of scientists. So the scientists over there clearly think differently to our own scientists, maybe. The Business Post, this is the ongoing obsession with indoor dining. Ministers and advisors clash over incredibly risky, quotes, indoor dining plans. So this is Cathal Walsh, who's a member of the Irish Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group. And he's saying that this idea the government has to tack on under 18s can go in and dine in with their parents. He says this is exactly what we don't want to happen. It's mixing young unvaccinated people with older vaccinated generations in the same environment. By the way, they also have an off lead there in the Business Post, which is that the global corporate tax rate, you know, which we are currently demurring to go along with, could be a bit over 15%, the OECD said. So we had that it was going to be at least 15%. Now it's going to be a bit over 15%. And I think it's those two words have Pascal Donohue and the government maybe keeping their powder dry for a while. The Sunday Independent, menacing phone calls to Holohan and Glynn. So they're getting late night menacing phone calls. And also RT's Fergal Bowers was targeted with something similar. So the Gardaí are looking into all that. They also are flagging on the front page an interview that Sinead O'Connor, who is, of course, now a journalist, did with Ian Bailey. And that's inside there. The Mail on Sunday, the Irish Mail on Sunday, Delta surge won't delay reopening plans. So, and they're saying poll shows public supports return of indoor dining. It's a bit more nuanced than that, I think. And then, look, the Sunday World and indeed the Mirror and the Sun all leading with that terribly sad story of that young GAA star, Brendan Ogue O'Duffy, who died in a car crash. And just hours after he had captained Monaghan under-20s in the Ulster semi-final. And so many families, communities, friends, clubs, everything reeling in shock. And everyone speaking very highly of that young man. Loss of a leader is the headline on the Sunday World. And the Mirror goes with teen GAA star dies in smash. And the Sun, similar GAA star dies in crash. Horror. So that a very sad story, and I'm sure everybody sending their condolences to that community and family and friends and everybody. Now, our panel this morning, Kingston Mills is Professor of Experimental Immunology at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology in Trinity College Dublin. Sheena Cahill is former President of the USI and currently Head of Communications with GOSCA, the President's Awards. And Kevin Doyle is the group head of news now at Media House. How are we saying this? Media House?
I think Media House.
Media House.
Okay, and hope there's not too many in the Netherlands listening.
Okay, we're Irishizing it down for ourselves. Media House. Okay, the locals.
Media Gaff.
That had their say.
Media Gaff. Yeah.
Okay, and you're all very welcome, and thank you all for coming in on this. On this beautiful day. Are we all enjoying the weather?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Kingston, you certainly look like somebody who... I'd say you're like me, having to deny you've been on a foreign holiday. Are you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on the bicycle the most sun, days, so I get the sun anyway. Any bit of sun, brown, great.
Yeah, yeah, mad for it. Kevin, you don't look as happy as Kingston.
No, I have a one-year-old at home, so it's very hard to go out for too long in that heat with the baby. But I was very tempted to wear the shorts in here, and I just about managed to put on the trousers, to be honest, Brendan.
Yeah. A boiled baby, we used to call that when we were bringing sweaty little pasty children around in the heat. And Sheena, you're loving it, are you?
I am not. I'm ginger, Brendan. Look at my pasty complexion and like 1,000 more freckles than I had the last time I was here. I actually hid yesterday completely.
Okay, so this is
this is
nice
actually
for you at all,
horrible. Yeah, and I know I'm that one who's like, oh, not the heat, because I stay indoors. But I'd get burnt looking out the window, to be honest. So I factor 50 is my friend when I am outside, and I have a little dog called Susan who couldn't sleep last night at all, so I was putting little damp towels on her just to keep her quiet.
Really? Listen, I think a lot of us would have done with damp towels last night. The dogs are getting better treatment than the humans. You see, this has been building up to this in this country. The dogs are being treated better than the humans at this stage now. Okay, well, listen, we better get on with the serious business of the day. Kingston Mills, I think I'm going to listen to you with a new kind of respect from now on, because the last time we spoke here a few weeks ago, there was no mention of, at that time, there had been no mention of vaccine passports to dine indoors. There was no great clamour to vaccinate the young. You were here and off a discussion from JP McMahon, you said yes. I mean, that vaccinated people would certainly be enough to keep the restaurant business going. And you also were pressing, as you had been for a while, to get the young people vaccinated. And Neffet clearly listening, but in 2 days, both of those things had happened. So you are now the
Good to hear that they're listening to me, finally.
I think, Kingston, a lot of people I've noticed in the last few days have started saying, is this going to end at all? How are we getting out of this? We thought we saw a clear path out of it, which was vaccination. But now it seems the waters have been muddied on that, and kind of a lot more people saying things like, oh yeah, we're going to be living with this for a long time, and oh, it's not going away, and you know, all of that. Do you see a path out of this?
Absolutely,
at this
point? I do. Yeah. I mean, I think the issue right now is this bit of data that we're missing, and that data is, what are the age of the people that are in hospital? We know that the numbers of people that are getting infected are mostly in the younger, some are in the older group, and some of those are people that have been fully vaccinated. We don't know. We know there are 3 children in Crumlin that have COVID-19, but we don't know the complete age profile. If they're in their 20s and 30s, I'd be less worried, because once they get vaccinated, that age group, then we would say that, you know, it's mostly going to be over. But if they're in their 60s or 70s, the people who are in hospital, then you'd be worried that their vaccine breakthroughs, or that people haven't responded to the vaccine so well, or the people who haven't been vaccinated still. So that information is going to be vital to determine where we're going
now,
to go.
Now, we do know from Leo Varadkar has said this, that of the 200 people in ICU, I think in recent months, 199 of them were not vaccinated.
Yes. That's in ICU. So that's good news for the vaccines. It's certainly, I mean, we know that anyway from the data from the UK, which is the UK are really on top of all the stats and data. And they've shown that in preventing hospitalizations, it's not 96% effective, the Pfizer vaccine, and 92% for the AstraZeneca. So they really do work at stopping hospitalizations. Okay. But we've moved a bit away from that now, and we're really looking at whether vaccines can stop infection. And with children, the big issue is long COVID. So about 10 to 20%, depending on the age, will have long-term symptoms of infection, even if it's a mild disease in children. That's the big
I'd
worry.
I'd like to come back to that in a while, because I do think it's something we want to focus on a little bit, because I think the conversation is crystallising around children at the moment. But I'd, I'd prefer to come back to it in a little while, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure.
In terms of the general path out of this, months, years, or
no, no,
weeks,
I think
if
that
we get, if in the next 6 weeks we get substantially most of the population vaccinated.
Yeah, I mean, if we get the vaccine, we hopefully on target to have all the adults vaccinated by the end of August, then we start on children, young adolescents between the ages of 16 to 18. That's where a lot of the transmission is right now. So the 18 to 24-year-old is the highest levels, but the next highest are the 12 to 18-year-olds. So, you know, it's mild disease there. So you might say, well, you know, let them get the infection and not worry about it. But I can't stop talking about the long COVID, unfortunately. So that's the consequence of not vaccinating that cohort. And of course, they can also get transmitted then back to people who are vulnerable, who, for example, haven't responded as well to the vaccine, older or people that are immune suppressed. So there's still the risk with them. But I do see...
Which is the point being made in that story in the business post.
But I'm optimistic by the end of August, things will be a lot better. I think we're going to see huge numbers of cases between now and then.
Okay.
They will be predominantly in the older or in the younger cohort with some of the older vaccine breakthroughs. And again, it's been a hobby horse of mine, but I think that NIAC have missed a trick by not doing the heterologous vaccination, the mixing of the vaccines, because it's been shown yet another publication last Friday showing that if you mix the vaccines, the immune response is 10 times better than by giving two doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. So one dose of AstraZeneca followed by a Pfizer or another mRNA like Moderna is 10 times more effective in generating the antibodies that protect you. So this is the way out of this. We give everybody in the country one dose of an mRNA vaccine, and then we protect much higher levels. You're leaving a group of people vulnerable by not having done this already.
Well, look, it would seem that argument is over now, because they're finishing up at the moment that over 60s cohort with a second AstraZeneca.
Everyone in that group is going to be, and some people in the over 50s, and some people with underlying medical conditions have been given two doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine, but they have to prioritise now in the autumn when the boosters are going to come, which is inevitable. Yeah. We're going to see a third dose. You know, hopefully that'll be a vaccine that's specifically designed to protect against the Delta
variant.
Which
Pfizer say they're doing.
All of the companies are doing it. Pfizer, Moderna and AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, all the vaccines in production right now, ready for testing in preparation for a third dose for the autumn.
Okay. Now, Sheena, speaking of which, I think we can tend to kind of forget that there is still a large unvaccinated population of people in your kind of an age group out there. You picked out a piece in the Mail today, hundreds on each pharmacy list, about, like, in fairness, there seems to be a healthy level of vaccine enthusiasm anyway, like.
Yeah, and I think there was a bit of discussion or chatter on Twitter during the week about the fact that I think it was the HSE or the Department of Health had put some money into Tinder and a few other dating apps to encourage them to kind of showcase that, you know, if you'd gotten your vaccine, you'd get an extra super like or a few extra right swipes on that. And there was a bit of clatter about that. And I think some people worried that the reason we were doing that was maybe because we were worried that young people weren't interested in getting the vaccine. But certainly, from even just chatting to people, right, anecdotally, I haven't really experienced anybody who has any hesitancy, and people are just mad to get their lives back and were bursting basically into pharmacies. And there was some incident, I think, in DCU even during the week that I heard tell of, where, you know, there was a rumour spread that there was vaccines going on campus, and sure, people like basically ran down to the pharmacy and somebody had to come out and be like, there's only three. So I certainly don't think there's hesitancy, but piece in the Mail on Sunday, across page and five and six, or six and seven, hundreds of people waiting on those lists. I most of my friends are haven't gotten their vaccine yet.
Yeah. And I presume, are they on lists all over?
They're
the
all
country?
On lists.
Every list they can get on.
Every list.
I know a young person from Dublin. I won't say who she is, but she got a jab in Monaghan the other day, delighted with herself. She was on every list.
I made a fatal error, which was I listed myself when I went to register with the, I suppose, the HSE program when it opened for kind of 25 to 29 year olds on Thursday. So at 12:01 after midnight, I registered. I'm sure I registered in Dublin at my Dublin address instead of down in Longford. And that was an error because I haven't gotten a text yet, but I'm not worried.
All your friends in Longford, they're probably done already.
They're getting them a bit quicker. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just on a population basis.
I presume it's helping as well that I think a lot of young people are thinking, I want to travel. I want to be able to get into the pub. So like the vaccine passport, I know it's controversial, but in Israel, it certainly seemed to encourage all the young people to get jabbed, and then they promptly kind of abandoned it. Kevin, I believe you're not jabbed.
No, I'm
not. And it's not an issue for
Look
you.
Look at the young head on him, though.
I can see the lividity in your face there. How old are you?
I'm 35, Brendan. I'm caught in the middle where I've been too young and healthy to be, you know, in the early cohorts that people were concerned about, and then I'm too old and boring to be prioritised with the young people who might all go mad and go to festivals or go travelling. So I'm
What age is that up to that you can register with a chemist?
So up to 34, you can get the pharmacy and get the Johnson one, but from 35 up, you have to wait for the HSE to get to you. So it's over a month since I registered. Now I finally have an appointment for next Thursday, but
you got the text.
I got the text, as they say on Love Island. But it is. I do feel there are a cohort of people around my age group who, I put it this way, I've been watching the debate about the people in their 60s with a raised eyebrow as they have bemoaned the fact that they got overtaken by some people in their 50s and in their 40s because they got the AstraZeneca, and therefore originally it was 12 or 8 weeks and now it's come back to 4, and they're all going to be sorted by the end of this week when hopefully I'll have got my first one. And so I'm kind of wondering, is it that there's this bunch of people in their 30s who are just too busy living life and trying to keep their head above water, that we're just not loud enough and that we've kind of been left behind in the middle. So as things go, I will get to the pub, Brendan, for a pint on the 2nd of September.
An outdoor summer there, Kevin. You and trying to keep a fan in the pram as you sip your outdoor pint. And listen, you also picked out, and you've alluded to there, that there's a broader issue here of generational unfairness, a feeling of that around. You picked out Lorcan Nyan's piece in the Sunday Independent today, Unfair Reopening Guidelines Put Young People's Ire on the Menu. But he's saying there are broader issues here.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to the idea that, and it goes back to the old cliche at this stage, that we're all in this together. And I think I see the government can't win, and the stats from the poll in the Mail show you that, because some people think it's reopening too slow and some people think it's not opening fast enough. But they have now divided society. And I think that is a dangerous road to go down now as we move into this next chapter. So I am what Tony Holohan and Neffet describe as the new vulnerable. I think that's the phrase they use to describe those of us that are kind of youngish and not vaccinated. And yet, when older people were the vulnerable, obviously everything shut down and everybody was expected to stay at home. But life is going on around us now, and I think this is kind of where it's going to become problematic. So,
and are you living your life extremely carefully?
Well, you see, this is the thing. I don't feel vulnerable. Yeah. And I'm trying to be realistic about this because I have to be careful and all the rest of it. But like, I was in Croke Park last night. There was 18,000 people at a match there. I was acutely aware that I wasn't vaccinated and therefore I have to be careful. But then I'm also aware I was at a work meeting last week, and we're all still working from home, but there had to be a meeting where there was a small few of us had to do it in real life rather than over the computer. I think there was 8 people there, and it was all done within the guidelines and socially distanced and all that. But I became acutely aware as the chatter was happening that I was the only person there not vaccinated. And suddenly I kind of felt like am I the vector? Like, the children were treated as the vector back at the very start of this. So I am living life carefully, but not carefully March 2020 carefully, as Leo Varadkar said.
Like, Kingston, it doesn't feel like people have that same fear factor they did back then. Even it seemed odd when Leo Varadkar said it, that people should live like that back then.
Everyone, I think, become sensitized to bombardment, which sometimes too much information can be a bad thing. Too much telling you what to do.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of falls on deaf ears after a while. The other thing is,
people be living their lives like it's March 2020 if they're not vaccinated? Well, it's difficult when everyone else seems to be getting.
I think the big issue is age, and I'm sort of the older person, the oldest person in the room quite a bit here, and I think your capacity for risk is inversely proportional to your age. So younger people in general are more risk takers than older. So the older population...
And less at risk as well.
Yeah. I mean, the older population re-cocooned. Some people, you know, kept indoors for a year until they got vaccinated and didn't go out, you know, which, you know, they were petrified of getting infected and dying from COVID-19. So, you know, and then they were so relieved to get their two doses of the vaccine. Even with the two doses of the vaccine, I know lots of, you know, older people are still, you know, not cocooning, but being careful.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the kind of the specific issue that's on the table, so to speak, and has been now for weeks, Sheena, is the reopening of indoor dining, which we've somehow have poured all of our kind of neuroses about this into the idea of indoor dining.
It's and the obviously, new banana bread.
Yeah, and look, it's a serious issue in that there are tens of thousands of jobs and everything dependent on it. You were looking at the Mail have a poll on some of this today, and we give all the caveats that it is an opinion poll, and you know there's margins of error and everything else. But if we just take it as anecdotal, the gist of it, about people's feelings about reopening and indoor dining. They're nuanced enough, aren't they?
Yeah, they're kind of more mixed. Yeah, the poll is of about 1,000 people. And I suppose the question, do you support the move to allow only those that are vaccinated to dine indoors in restaurants? Yes, kind of 59%, no, 35%. And again, as Kevin kind of alluded to earlier, I think that the second question it appears in that poll, which was about what is your view of the most recent plans for reopening? There's a lot more complexity in that one and the answer there, because 38% are saying things are opening up at about the right pace, 25% saying things are opening up too little, 35%, so actually not very much, so 35% saying things are opening up too much, and then 38% saying about the right pace. So actually there's not as broad a consensus potentially as we think, maybe around the reopening. There's more maybe consensus.
And if you look at it, there's another question, isn't there, of will you actually go and to an indoor?
There is indeed. 47% saying they intend to attend a pub or restaurant once they reopen. But actually that compares to 44% who said they wouldn't. So there's that hesitancy of going back into that indoor space. And I think that's a really interesting conversation based on even that question of the divided society. Because for me and for a lot of people much younger than me who predominantly work in service, I think that the feeling that, OK, we've gone to that kind of half life now where all the people kind of my parents' age, kind of 50 and older, are like starting to return to normal, and kind of it feels like they're demanding that normalcy back. But
who is delivering that is the young people.
I know that obviously person by person, that's not how people think about this. But I know a lot of young people who, you know, are going to be in a situation where they would be expected to serve people, you know, in those areas. And, you know, I had a conversation last night about whether, you know, well, could we compare that to the fact that there wasn't really any outcry when Penny's burst open its doors and obviously young people were working there. But the point I would make is that, you know, even if you're going in browsing into Penny's and young people are serving you or at the cash register, you're wearing a mask. So the risk of you, you know, the young person getting it or passing it on is less in that situation. But I do think that that's where that division, certainly not only with the delay and in many understandable ways of getting to the younger and healthier people for vaccinations is very much live and kicking. Yeah. But again, if you're suggesting that I should be serving you oysters, you know, because you're over 60, I would greatly contest that.
Yeah, I know where you shoved those oysters. Kevin, on all that, I noticed there's muttering started to happen. Now, we'll come to our friends in the UK in a minute, but there is muttering starting to happen about a change in the tone of the conversation around the indoor dining. We see the front page of the Business Post today, and there's a piece inside and people are saying there was a change of tone around the news and primetime last Thursday, and that they feel that by next Wednesday or Thursday, the conversation could have changed completely, that some restaurateurs are saying we're not banking on any reopening happening. Is there a sense that the government has now decided we're going for this come hell or high water, we're doing this, and that is the health advice getting a bit louder now to say take it easy here?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, we've already, I suppose, we've in some ways we've been focused on the row about should kids be allowed in or not in. And that was kind of like step one. But it is now moving up to step two, which is should anybody be allowed in? And we had that debate 2-3 weeks ago. And I think we're probably going to have it again in the next 10 days or so as we get closer to July 26th, which is now D-Day.
The politicians are doubling down on it, like it's going ahead.
They are absolutely. The government has. It's if you go back to Christmas and think about what happened there and the kind of snap decision that they had to make to close everything off again, they don't want to do that again. And the mantra this time all along has been, when we open, we stay open. Now, there is, I think, a growing fear that can they follow through on that idea of staying open?
Well, we hit 1,000 cases weeks before we were supposed to. We're now at, 1,400? 2,000 was meant to be by the end of the month. I presume at this rate we'll get there.
And people were trashing the NPHET modelling, if you remember. Lots of people without any scientific grounding were trashing the NPHET modelling.
Is the reality changing here? And do we need to, as any sane person does, change our minds when the facts change?
I think we do. I mean, I think I was an advocate, as you know, and you said earlier, of enabling people to take part in activities such as travel and dining when they're vaccinated, fully vaccinated. Yeah. And I still believe that.
But has Delta changed
With Delta, I mean, the vaccines, two doses are very effective at preventing hospitalizations. They're not going to be 100% at preventing infection, especially the AstraZeneca vaccine. So that does still pose a risk. I think the question of the under 18-year-olds going to pubs is a very emotive one because families don't want to bring their children and happy to leave them outside. But I think that, we know there's lots of transmission in the younger age groups, and sort of we're making rules and then we're sort of tearing them up at the same time. We're saying people can go to restaurants if they're vaccinated, and if you're not vaccinated, you can't. But they said we'll make an exception for the under 18-year-olds. But a 17-year-old can get infected and transmit it. I don't want to stop the under 18-year-olds going to pubs and restaurants, but certainly they shouldn't be going to pubs in the first place, but to restaurants. So, but I think if we're going to be safe about it, we really have to confine it to those are vaccinated.
There is a bit of a view in government, Brendan. It goes back to something a minister said to me way back at the start of all of this, which was that if you are a member of NPHET or a senior medical advisor in a role like that with the HSE Department of Health, the safest thing for you is if nobody ever leaves their house.
Of course.
Stay where you are.
Caution is really rewarded here, isn't it? Because like you make a decision now and people die in 3 weeks' time, you're the worst in the world. Whereas if you do nothing, now, listen, never mind how we are doubling down and proceeding, but in the UK, they're really going for it. Tomorrow is Freedom Day, of course. And on the line now is Lisa O'Carroll, who is a journalist with The Guardian. Lisa, good morning. Lisa, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now, Lisa. Good morning, Lisa. So listen, Lisa, there's a lot going on over there. Can we start with the optics are not good of the immediate news this morning, which that as the UK faces Freedom Day tomorrow and getting rid of everything, all restrictions, opening nightclubs and everything else, you have the Health Secretary and the Prime Minister and others potentially are now going to be going into isolation.
Yes, indeed. We learned yesterday that the Health Secretary has tested positive for COVID and that the Chancellor and Boris Johnson would have to self-isolate under the rules. However, this morning, the big controversy, just a few hours ago, was that they were not going to self-isolate because they were part of this pilot scheme which allows people who have been tested every day in an office situation to continue work without self-isolating. So that led to a hue and cry, everybody criticising that yet again, it's like Matt Hancock, it is, do what I say, not what I do.
Yeah, because this is against the background of what they're calling the pingdemic, where at the moment, I think there were 500,000 people pinged last week by their app to isolate. But I think in total, when you take in people told to isolate in other ways, was there 1.25 million people in the UK last week had to go into isolation?
I'm not sure. It was definitely 530,000 pinged by the app, which requires you to self-isolate, so basically stay at home for 10 days. And the problem with this is, there are two problems. There's a technical problem, which is related to the how credible that ping app is. because there have been instances of the app pinging through your neighbour's wall. We've had the head of the co-op supermarket chain saying that in her experience, say in a five-storey block, that you've got somebody who is isolated on a work floor on floor one, is test positive, but the app pings to floor five when there's been no contact between floor five and 5-1, but floor five and one. But that's one issue. But the big issue here about the pandemic is that we've got this strange situation tomorrow where Boris Johnson is restoring people's liberties and their freedom, but at the same time sending people into isolation. And that is already having a knock-on effect in businesses where in-person work is necessary. So we're talking all of hospitality, we're talking meat processing plants, we're talking car manufacturing. So, for example, Nissan and Rolls-Royce have said that they have had to readjust their production line because of absences. We have got councils throughout the north of England suspending bin collections, like garden waste and recycling bin collections. And we have, you know, possible big shortages in the NHS among staff who have to self-isolate.
And I believe some of the tube lines were compromised yesterday because of people out.
Yes, there were. Yeah, I think there are a lot of people saying that they've got one in four out. Like Liverpool Council has said, they've got 25% out from self-isolation and sickness. And the thing with the Delta variant is because the symptoms are a cold, you know, a sniffle and a runny nose, etc. So it's not quite like the Beta variant, or sorry, the Kent variant, the Alpha one.
Yeah.
But anybody who has a minor cold come autumn will not be allowed into work.
Yeah. And also, if you take it that you're at 50,000, over 50,000 cases a day at the moment, but they're expecting it to go to, it's doubling every 2 weeks. If it goes to 100,000 in 2 weeks, presumably that's twice as many people again are pingdemicked. So the concern is here, this cripples the UK economy.
That's right. And Neil Ferguson, who's known as Professor Lockdown early on last year, was on Andrew Marr on the BBC this morning saying that, you know, the fear is that, yes, go to 100,000, but what if it goes to 200,000? And then you get significant increase in numbers of hospitalizations, not necessarily deaths. But he said that will have a big impact on the burden the NHS will have to carry. So he was also interested in talking about, he was asked, you know, if we think that Boris Johnson is trying to engineer herd immunity before the flu season starts, so that's a big fear, that you have COVID and flu in the hospital system at the same time.
Yeah.
If you get herd immunity before October, then you're kind of securing the NHS services. So he was talking, Professor Ferguson was talking about a 6 to 8 week kind of, it's an experiment really, but if you get enough people catching COVID, not his words, mine, catching COVID, but not being particularly ill, then you have a population that's safe. But anyway, this,
and in terms of this, like, it is a massive gamble, I think, that the government is taking tomorrow in opening everything fully, as I say, including like nightclubs and things like that. There seems to be a lot of scientific opinion against it, and I think the public, a substantial minority, if not a majority of them, are now against it as well, are they?
Well, I think you've probably got two cohorts, like you do in Ireland. You've got older people who are double vaccinated who will remain cautious and who will remain wearing masks. And if you've got a younger population who aren't getting very sick, won't get very sick, aren't worried about long COVID, although they should be, who will, you know, rush back into the restaurants. Restaurants here have been open for quite some time, as have pubs indoor. But nightclubs, you know, they have run some experiments and pilots in Amsterdam and also in the UK. You know, the music industry is desperate to get back.
Mm.
Not just, you know, nightclubs, but gigs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Lisa, the line is not great there, but thank you for that. Lisa O'Carroll, correspondent with The Guardian. Kingston, you can see Lisa's point there that, look, all these industries want to get back and everything. But on the other hand, we're hearing that basically, you know, 1,200 scientists in the Lancet, like the chief medical scientific officer over there himself said on a on a kind of a webinar the other night that this could spiral out of control very quickly. They could be back into lockdown. The eyes of the world are on them, we're told. Is this complete madness? What's going on there?
I think the idea that they're going to get to herd immunity by allowing all the young people to get infected is completely irresponsible, I would call it, because it's simply not going to happen that we're going to get herd immunity through natural immunity, as they call it, through infection. Because effectively what will have to happen, about 60 or 70% of the under 18s need to get infected to reach that, because right now we only have in the UK 63% of the adult population are fully vaccinated. To get to herd immunity,
not far off us.
Not far off. You're not much ahead. So to get to herd immunity with this variant, you need, they reckon, 85% of the entire population, we're not just talking about adults,
yeah,
either infected or double vaccinated. And you can see that those figures are just simply not going to be reached by allowing a significant number of children to get infected. So it's not going to happen. They're not going to get herd immunity in the UK in this year, absolutely out of the question. And all the scientists, nearly all the scientists in the UK agree with that.
Okay, and look, we see today as well that they're talking about not vaccinating most children. So
yeah, I mean, completely bizarre. It goes against the advice of WHO, the EMA, goes against what the FDA are saying.
Okay,
we'll come
back to it after the break. But clearly what it does mean is the plan is to let it rip through children.
Yeah, Sweden, of course, did that early on in the pandemic. They decided we weren't going to lock down. We're just going to let the thing go through. And then they had to pull back on that because so many people were dying.
Okay, let's take a quick break. Kingston Mills, Sheena Cahill and Kevin Doyle staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Kingston Mills, Sheena Cahill and Kevin Doyle. Now, we've been touching on the issue of the vaccination of children, and the front page of the Sunday Times today saying children under 16 will be vaccinated. Jonathan Howerhan is on the line now. Jonathan is a consultant at Temple Street and Professor of Paediatrics at the RCSI University School of Medicine and Health Sciences. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
You want to see children vaccinated as soon as possible?
I do. I don't see why they shouldn't be vaccinated. COVID affects children. Why would we allow a large proportion of our population to be unvaccinated, both for their own health and for the health of the people they engage with?
And yesterday, Jonathan, I think a lot of people were a bit shocked to hear on this show that one in seven children likely to get children who get COVID are likely to get long COVID, and Kingston presenting similar figures there. So I think a lot of people are tending to think, do we really need to worry that much about children? They're not getting very sick with it. Do we need to be more worried about our children? Because I think a lot of people are letting them kids live their lives a bit more these days and interact with friends and different things. Should we be kind of locking down a bit more with the kids?
Well, we're in the very early stages of COVID long-term effects. And we'll have to see how that plays out. There's different forms of long COVID. There's the chronic illness kind of COVID, and then there's the chronic medical diagnoses related COVID, like children with heart problems or lung problems and memory, you know, neurological issues. So we're still early into that observation period. I think children need to live their lives, and if vaccinating them allows live their lives as normally as possible, that's another reason to do it, because children have been very inhibited and curtailed and corralled because of COVID.
Okay.
No, it's been effective
but
in stopping
them getting
COVID. But prior
to them being
COVID,
vaccinated, though, should we be restricting our children's lives fairly tightly at the moment before they're vaccinated?
I think we still have to worry that people who are uninhibited in their movements through a community are going to either catch COVID and disseminate it too. So I'm still in favour of social distancing and other reasonable personal public health precautions.
Have you come across many children sick with COVID in Temple Street or in your work in general?
We haven't had very many sick children. There's only been a few ICU admissions. I'm personally not aware of a death in Ireland due to COVID, but they are around the world. There have been cases of this very complicated syndrome that's like Kawasaki's disease in children.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And children with complicated medical conditions are very vulnerable to COVID. So we've got to, within the general children's population, we've got our chronic sick children too, like in other age groups.
Okay, so we should be starting with them. Okay, Professor Jonathan Howerhan, thank you very much for that. Kevin, you all actually picked out that front page of the Sunday Times about the vaccination of children. Kevin, is this going to be politically tricky? Because I know a lot of people who were first in the queue to get a vaccine themselves, and they're curiously kind of thinking a bit more about giving it to their kids.
Well, that's literally what I was going to say, Brendan, is that we've talked a lot about vaccine hesitancy for young people. I think parents will have got the vaccine themselves, no bother, but will stop and think twice, and there will be a hesitancy about giving it to their children. And it's a natural thing. But I think that puts the onus very firmly on NIAC and in turn the government to make a quick decision here, because we had all that back and forth on AstraZeneca, and it created this whole buzz where AstraZeneca kind of became the unwanted vaccine. Yeah. And I think if we allow that debate to happen here, I think they need to come out with the facts and the information very quickly around this, and a clear target and travel direction of travel, because if they let that debate happen like it did with AstraZeneca, they will lose a lot of people.
Yeah. Kingston, I was reading something in America. There's some guy who had crunched all the numbers. He said like that there's a better chance of your child dying from the flu than there is of dying from coronavirus. There's a greater chance of your child dying by suicide, by drowning, by car accident, by practically, you know, he went across the whole gamut, and they are the numbers. Like,
yeah, in terms of deaths, that's absolutely the case. There's very few deaths, as Professor
Horan
said.
So can you see then why people...
Yeah, absolutely.
There's probably no good reason for it, but but what would you say to them?
But I mean, the issue is, first of all, we need to enable the young people to get back to doing what they want to do. And we talk about going back to school in October or September, or the end of August, whenever schools open.
Do you think we need vaccination before then?
I mean, this is going to become, transmission is going to be huge in schools if in the autumn if they're not vaccinated. So, you know, at the end of the last term,
need to look at getting this done before September. Yeah.
I think we need to do it as soon as we possibly can, as vaccine supply permits. That's the issue. We need to get all the adults vaccinated first, obviously, and then start on the 17 to 18 year olds.
But people need have absolutely no worry about getting their children vaccinated. There's no
I wouldn't have any worry about if I had the children that age. My children are a bit older, but and they've incidentally been fully vaccinated. But the issue is the long COVID. That's the big issue for the young children. And we know that people even with mild symptoms can get long COVID.
Have we seen a lot of children with long COVID? Do we have any research on it?
Yeah, I mean, the Ireland doesn't have much in the way of stats that I've seen, but the UK and the US studies showing it's 10% up to 20% with older children.
With children, okay. All right.
So it's real.
Grand. Okay. Now, listen, there is still politics in the world, maybe a bit more politics around than there's been in a while, in a way, Kevin. The Sunday Times have taken a very interesting, I'd call it a line because their editorial is there as well as a piece with Justine McCarthy about the Dublin-based South by-election. And actually, it's interesting in the context of what we're reading about those calls as well to Tony Holohan and Ronan Glynn and stuff. And what they're saying is that the people who put them, and Deirdre Conroy is saying this in an interview with Justine McCarthy, she felt she was treated very badly by the media and in the conversation. They say in their editorial, all the candidates were actually treated very badly. When you think that Owen Murphy got out partially, we think, because of dogs' abuse.
Mm. There's no doubt that politics has become far more toxic. Now, I would take issue with some of Deirdre Conroy's analysis of the campaign and this idea that people shouldn't have brought up things that she said previously, things that particularly around housing, which is a big issue here, things that she implied about foreign nationals. So I don't think you can get a free pass because something happened 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Yeah.
So I do take issue with the idea that she seems to suggest that the campaign should purely have been about what she wanted to talk about, which was her platform and her policies, because in a by-election, you're kind of unfortunate in some ways because it's a little bit like a presidential election.
It was a bit, wasn't it?
It becomes all about the person, the candidate. And you know, in a general election, there's 38, 40 constituencies and there's dozens and hundreds of candidates. And so it's all spread out. But in a by-election, it becomes very focused on maybe 4 or 5 people, because although there's 15 people on the ballot paper, really there's only 4 or 5 in the shake-up. And if you're the candidate for the big party, well, for one of the big parties, then inevitably there is a focus on you.
And like they're saying in their editorial piece that it wasn't just Deirdre Conroy. James Gagan was kind of pilloried for owning a house.
Yeah, James Gagan got
and he's privileged and all the rest of it.
Deirdre Conroy in her interview is actually saying that women women, this would deter women going into politics, but I actually not, women get it horrific on social media. But I think that's the point. It would deter anyone. I mean, James Gagan was derided in many ways because both his parents were Supreme Court judges. His grandfather was a politician and a judge as well. And basically that he came from money, which was the clear implication that was put out there. And look, that was portrayed in the media, and it was talked about that he had bought quite an expensive house while trying to while his campaign was all about being the voice for the locked out generation.
Yeah.
So it is. Yeah. And the editorial makes the point. But if we don't want these young, well-educated types going into politics, who do we want going into politics? And you need a mix of those people. You need a mix of people from maybe less educated, from poorer backgrounds, who have that life experience. And you need those from...
Yeah, and people from poorer backgrounds can be very well-educated as well. Let's just make
Of course,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah. And Sheena, of course, a woman did win the boy election in the end.
Yeah.
So, it was a good result for
It was,
for
absolutely.
Women.
Yeah, I mean, look, personally, I think this isn't a women issue. I think this is the Deirdre Conroy issue, I'll be honest. Particularly, like, you know, you can't say things like, you know, strangers went searching for things about me online when you're running for election and act shocked. Like, of course they did.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, anyone doing their due diligence about a possible candidate in their area or through the media.
Yeah.
And Kevin's right.
But you know what? I think
it is like
a
presidential
personality
election.
There was a microscope on it nationally and everything.
Absolutely.
And
but
would have been local skirmish stuff.
Also, just
yeah.
Brendan, like, cry me a river in that editorial about the editorial's worry that, you know, if we don't accept, you know, these great young shirted men like, you know, James Gahigan with all his great qualifications, will be left overpopulated with social activists who've lived blameless lives. I mean, again, look, that's ridiculous. I mean, of course there was a heavy media presence on a by-election this time around, and
yeah,
of course those candidates got more airtime media-wise than most constituency candidates running around the country. But I don't think the problem is that we're suddenly next election going to run out of landlords in the Dáil. So again, not concerned about that myself.
Okay, but Sheena, I tell you what though. Show me the person who's led a blameless life. Like, I don't know any.
You won't
of them.
Find one, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you do have a blameless or blameful life, you should be aware that if you're running for election, people are going
to
look you up.
Yeah, okay.
Well, and to be honest, we also have a very forgiving electorate, and I won't name names, but there are plenty of people in Dáil Éireann with very sketchy backgrounds, and it's well known to the electorate, and they still put them in there.
Yeah. Now, Kevin, the other big political issue across the paper today, and like, you know, they must be bemoaning the fact that there's nothing else going on. I'd say Fianna Fáil thought they might have been able to move on, that they had put, stuck their finger in the dike vis-a-vis the fulminations about leadership and everything else. But like the papers today, full of Fianna Fáil and existential questions for it. The two things you picked are both interviews. One is with Barry Cowan and the other is with...
Mark McSharry,
yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of, there's actually more about Fianna Fáil in the papers this weekend than I thought there would be, which kind of shows you that in some ways, would Micheál Martin prefer we're talking about this or the row about indoor dining? You kind of have to wonder. But either way, the papers are not good reading for Micheál Martin today. On Mark McSharry, I'll mention that briefly, but I think the Barry Cowan stuff is perhaps more interesting. Barry Cowan's done two interviews, one in the Sunday Business Post and one in the Sunday Independent. But Mark McSharry, who obviously is has for quite a long time been against Micheál Martin. He just believes he is not the man to lead Fianna Fáil, and he has never been shy about saying that he is the one. When we talked about this heave and this getting 10 names to have a motion of no confidence, that's all Mark McSharry. It's all driven by Mark McSharry. And it's the only quote I really pick out from that interview, because a lot of it is what you expect Mark McSharry to say, is that he does, it's put to you, O'Connell puts it to him, that you're the only person out saying this. You're the only one verbalising it in the real world. Everyone else in the shadows. And he goes, that's not true. That's not true. You know that. You know that. And
do you know that?
Yeah, he's not on his own.
Yeah.
But he's the only one who's willing to go publicly agitating, because everybody else feels that there is a longer game, or there is more to lose right now by creating this kerfuffle in the middle of everything else that's going on.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
on the Barry Cowan stuff, because Barry Cowan has probably over the last few weeks become the other Fianna Fáil backbencher who is out agitating quite a lot. And he's taking a very different line, which isn't, we don't have to cut the legs from under Micheál Martin now, but we do need to turn the party on its head. And I think there's two really interesting things. There's a lot of history between the Cowans and Micheál Martin. Obviously, Micheál Martin took over from Barry Cowan, from Brian Cowan as Taoiseach. And interestingly, Barry quotes back something that Micheál Martin said back in 2010, which is, it's always dangerous, watch what you say, because it'll come back and haunt you in politics, which was that Fianna Fáil must recognise the reality of the current climate of public opinion. And I think that might be the problem ultimately for him.
And Barry Cowan is suggesting a centre-left alliance with Labour.
Yes, on the back of a by-election which Labour won. It's quite interesting, but he does...
So he really means an alliance with Ivana Bacci or people like her, essentially.
I think there's a little bit of that. Labour.
Sure, it's like, remember
that film Barton Fink, like, and it was like, we got to, in every movie they made then, there was this guy Barton Fink had one good script. We got to get the Barton Fink feeling. We all want the Ivana Bacci feeling now, basically.
There's a little bit of that. Is Ivana Bacci is the lifeboat. Can we cling on to it? Look, it's interesting. It probably says something about where both parties are at, though, rather than much more.
And listen, there are other things going on in the broader world there. Kingston, you're a big sports fan and you have been very vocal all the way through this about the importance of sport, very keen to get it back, to get people back to sport and everything. The Olympics, is this a Boris Johnson style kind of madness going against the tide of everything that's happening around them, or what do you think?
I think it's a tough one. I mean, you know, in Japan, the people there are, you know, vehemently against it. But I think what they have to remember is their government stands to lose billions and billions of dollars if it doesn't go ahead. And of course, all the athletes who've been training for 5 years now in preparation for this would have to wait another year or maybe miss out on ever the chance of Olympics. There's been one case in the Olympic Village, which is small.
Two overnight now, I think.
Two more, is it? Right.
Yeah. You know, so it's doubling every 24 hours.
Really? Okay,
if I was an epidemiological modeller, I'd be saying
that. It's not going to be so good if it goes at that
exponential
rate.
Growth, that would be, wouldn't it?
Now, they did do a deal with Pfizer in that every athlete was supposed to get two doses of
the
vaccine, but I think they didn't all get, and that was the point. And the other issue is that not all the entourage. I mean, you think that when a team of maybe 100 people go to from a country, there could be 200 officials between coaches and administrative staff, and they all have to be vaccinated.
They've cut that back a good bit, I gather.
So the issue is around the staff, and then once you have one case, it's containing that and stopping the spread within a team. So I think there are going to be trials and tribulations. I mean, it was similar with the Lions tour to South Africa. I think in some ways that was more risky than the Olympics, because the numbers of cases in Japan is still relatively low compared with what it is in South Africa. It's completely out of control in South Africa. I think the Olympics is still, you know, not in jeopardy by any means, but this is certainly not making it easy for them.
Okay, but in general, would you be in favour of that we need to get on with these things and accept that there will be a bit of...
And sport is the one situation. I mean, I'm sort of amazed that all the focus has been on when are we going to go to the pub to have a pint. And, you know, it's... And there's very little focus about when are young kids going to get back playing fully? When is football going to have supporters? Yeah. I mean, we're having it slowly, but we haven't embraced it in the same way as we've embraced the argument.
And we're losing boys and we're losing girls, I'm told. You know, I'm told by people who do coaching and stuff that they're really frantically trying to make sure they don't miss that window with the girls.
Absolutely. I mean, sport is such an important part of development, and I think that if we curtail that for 2 years, effectively, it's going to be a huge gap in those young development of those young people.
Kevin, what was Croke Park like last night?
I felt that you could be safe if you chose to be safe, if that makes sense. So
personal responsibility you're talking about.
Yeah, it came in a big way. I mean, to be honest, like the rules were you had to wear a mask at all times. Now, it was, what you say in the headlines, 29 degrees, Brendan, sitting in a stadium wearing a mask. Nobody was. When people sat down, it was, okay, I say nobody. A few people were, but the vast, vast, vast majority of people took their masks off when they sat down
in
their seat.
And there was nobody telling them to put their masks back
on. One steward tried at one stage, but like as soon as she turned her back, everybody had it off again. It was that kind of schoolboy
thing. And were people in bubbles and spread out? Or
Yeah, it was. And if you saw it on the telly, the stadium actually looked quite empty. But when you were there, it actually felt much more full than it looked on television, to be honest. 18,000 people is still a lot of people, even if you are spread around the stadium. So I kind of felt like there was a few youngish lads down in front of me. They'd managed to sneak in a few cans and stuff, and you were kind of going, oh God. And so you did kind of watch if you were aware of it. But, you know, you were 2 meters away from everybody in your seat, apart from the people that were in your bubble.
So I was one of the last unvaccinated people in the country and one of the new vulnerable. Did you feel safe in this situation, or did you think, this is a bit iffy?
No, I did. I felt safe, but having said that, I left with a couple of minutes left on the clock so that I didn't have to do that tunnel squash on the way out.
OK, all right. Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News at Media House. Thank you very much. Sheena Cahill, Head of Communications with Goshka, the President's Award, and Kingston Mills Professor of Experimental Immunology. Thank you all very much. That was a very lively hour.